All right, the committee will come to order. Representative Murphy, will you move the February 18th and February 24th minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Any questions or discussion on that? All right, seeing none, all in favor of those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Okay, Representative Bly, House File 135. Representative Lane?
Yes, I would like to move House File 135 be passed and be referred to Commerce.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members. I've asked that several handouts be distributed to you, and I'll just offer a quick explanation of them. There's an orange handout that's two-sided. One side kind of gives some high points of the bill that I'm going to be talking about today. The reverse side cites a Colorado Blue Ribbon study that compared four universal coverage proposals that they considered. The last one is a plan that's similar to the Minnesota Health Plan. The green packet has information about the effects of the rising cost of health care. The blue packet contains some recent articles explaining the positive economic impact of the plan, like the one I'm proposing today. I've asked five advocates to testify, three from my own district and two who have other experiences that they wanted to share, and they'll follow my testimony. I want to say without going further that I'm proud to present to you today Senator Marty's work on reforming our health care system. It's been a pleasure to work with him, and I want to acknowledge the years of work and leadership he has provided on this issue. I know many of you are familiar with the facts about the economic challenges our health system offers, but just a brief reminder, the costs of health emergencies and disease are the leading causes of bankruptcy. In most cases, that happened to individuals who had health insurance. In fact, medical costs are the leading cause of bankruptcy over all other reasons combined. The rising cost of access has adverse effects on our economy at all levels, business, school districts, local governments, state governments, etc. In Minnesota, we experience an 8.9% growth in per year costs to state governments. $35 billion is the total cost of health care in the state of Minnesota, which is the same as $7,000 per person and $21,000 for a family of three. By 2015, in less than 7 years, it will be $55 billion, bigger than the entire state budget. 400,000 Minnesotans have no insurance. According to a study released by Health Affairs, one in five Americans are underinsured. A consumer report study indicated that one in four non-elderly Americans is underinsured. A guess might be that 1 million Minnesotans are underinsured, which means their insurance does not provide them with the health access they need. There are human costs. 18,000 people die every year in this country because of lack of health care coverage. The state of our health care system could be summed up in by a paragraph from an essay by Robert Kuttner in 2004. He said, "Today, the system of employer-based health insurance combined with the tender mercies of managed care is a shambles. Expenses are out of control, but the cost containment pinches in the wrong places. Hospitals are shutting their doors, while new for-profit hospitals for special surgery leech money from the rest of the system. Most people lack pharmaceutical coverage. Doctors and patients alike resent the bureaucracy, the cost shifting, the denial of necessary care, the interposition of case reviewers between physician and patient, the skimming of scarce health dollars, the paper chase, the insecurity of coverage, and the plain misallocation of resources." As reported in a recent Frontline program by reporter T.R. Reid, the Taiwanese traveled the world to search for the best model of health care delivery. When they left the United States, where they came first, they discovered it is not a health system that we have here, but a market where what happens, happens. They decided it could not meet the goals they had set for themselves of providing a fair system. They learned from all the countries they visited and developed a system of national health insurance with administrative costs of 2% or less, where no one goes bankrupt and everyone has access. They consider health care a public good, like police and fire services, like public schools, something that we all benefit from. It is their contention that there is tremendous value in that greater good. What if we did as the Taiwanese did and asked ourselves, if we could start over, what would be the best way to meet our goals and be able to afford it? The bill before you is an attempt to answer that question. We believe that a major factor in cost is the enormous administrative waste generated by 300-plus insurance companies that operate in this state, waste they pay for directly and waste they impose on clinics and hospitals and other providers who have to deal with them. Our employer-based multi-payer system is no longer supportable. It locks us into limited care and access, limiting choice of doctor and care, and locks too many people out of the care they need. In addition, it has become a huge drag on the economy and all government expenditures. Too many of the assumptions private managed care systems are based on are not supported by evidence and create unevenness and unpredictability. We believe the plan established by the Minnesota Health Act will bring order and improve choice and access for all Minnesotans. In the Minnesota Health Plan, which this act would establish, we begin with 9 explicit criteria that the Minnesota Health Plan is required to meet. The plan must cover every Minnesotan. The health plan must cover all necessary care, including dental, prescription drugs, mental health, chemical dependency treatment, and long-term care. Patients are free to choose their own doctors and other medical professionals. The plan will be financed by premium payments based on ability to pay, so that health care is affordable to everyone. The health plan must save money through prevention, efficiency, and reduction of bureaucracy, but not by delaying or denying care. The plan must ensure that there are sufficient well-trained medical providers and facilities to meet the medical needs of people in every community. The plan must be operated in a manner that continues Minnesota's leadership in medical education, training, research, and technology. Section 2 of the bill contains some general provisions, such as the naming of the plan and some definitions about medically necessary and so forth. This section prohibits conflicts of interest for the employees and the board of the Minnesota Health Plan. Article 2, eligibility. All Minnesota residents are eligible. The board shall provide residents with identification they can use to confirm their eligibility with health care providers. Residents temporarily out of state are covered. Non-residents receiving medical services in Minnesota will be billed for those services. The board may extend coverage to non-residents employed in Minnesota who pay premiums on an ability-to-pay basis. All retirees eligible for retiree benefits under a contract with an employer will continue to receive those benefits. Article 3, Benefits, Section 1, spells out that residents may get their care from any licensed provider. All medically necessary services are covered, including preventive services and immunizations, prescription drugs, mental health care, dental care, chemical dependency treatment, emergency transportation, medical equipment, and so forth. There are no deductibles or co-payments for patients to avoid discouraging people from obtaining needed care. Section 2 provides that all patients have a primary care nurse or doctor to serve as a care coordinator. Specialists or other medical providers may serve as a care coordinator if the provider and patient choose. Article 4, Funding. Section 1 creates the Minnesota Health Fund, which collects premium payments from individuals and employers. All premiums collected go directly to the Minnesota Health Plan, not the state treasury, and can only be used to pay for the health plan. The fund has 3 major accounts: operating, capital, and reserves. The operating account is divided into accounts dedicated to medical services, community prevention programs, planning and assessment training, and development for healthcare professionals and medical research. All medical claims are billed to the Minnesota Health Fund, which pays all of the bills. Section 2 requires that the board set premiums based on ability to pay for individuals and employers. The Minnesota Health Plan will seek any necessary waivers from the federal government to enable all federal payments for programs such as Medicare and Medicaid to be paid directly to the Minnesota Health Plan. If the federal government approves, the Minnesota Health Plan would pay all medical bills currently paid by those programs, including the money currently paid by Medicare and Medicaid recipients through co-pays and deductibles. Section 3 spells out that when a patient has health coverage from some other source, the board is to collect reimbursement from that insurer. Such sources might include a court judgment for medical injury or from a retiree health plan. Article 5, Payments, requires the Minnesota Health Plan Board to pay medical providers at rates negotiated with the providers and allows payments to be made for care coordination and for ancillary health care or social services that are currently funded by Medicaid or other funds that would be transferred to the Minnesota Health Fund. There can be geographic differences in rates if needed to address provider shortages. For example, if there are not enough nurses or primary care doctors in small rural communities, they can pay higher rates in order to recruit more providers for those communities. The board shall reimburse hospitals, nursing homes, and other institutional providers through annual budgets that are negotiated based on anticipated changes in costs and services provided. This avoids the time-consuming, extremely costly practice of having hospital staff bill separately for each dose of oxygen, each pill, and each service provided to each patient. Medical facilities wanting to make large capital expenditures must get approval from the MHP board to ensure that there are not an excessive number of costly facilities to any particular location. Article 6, Government. Section 1 clarifies the Minnesota Health Plan has its own dispute resolution process instead of the one used by the state government. To set an example and to reduce the administrative expenses for the MHP, Section 2 caps the salary of the top administrator of the plan. Section 3 creates the Minnesota Health Board, which administers the MHP. The board is required to ensure that the Minnesota Health Plan provides high-quality health care to all Minnesotans and that all 9 requirements spelled out in Article 1 are met. To fulfill these requirements, the board's duties include creating an Office of Health Planning and Quality, approving a statewide budget as well as budgets for each of 6 regions of the state, establishing and collecting premium payments, negotiating fees and budgets with providers, evaluating the performance of the Minnesota Health Plan, ensuring the plan promotes optimum physical and mental health, and ensuring strong public health services. The board will consist of 15 members serving 4-year terms, appointed by the regional board. 8 of the members come from the regional boards, and 7 will be at-large members. Each of the 5 regional boards from Greater Minnesota appoint 1 member to the Minnesota Health Board, and the Metropolitan Regional Board will appoint 3 members. These 8 members from the regional boards appoint the 7 at-large members. The at-large members represent medical providers, consumers, and employers. Section 4 creates 6 health planning regions around the state. The metropolitan region covers the 7 metropolitan counties. The boundaries of the other 5 planning regions will be determined according to several criteria, including population and patterns of health care service use. Section 5 deals with the Regional Health Planning Board. The board of the Metropolitan Planning Region consists of 2 county commissioners from each of the 7 metropolitan counties. The boards of the 5 rural planning regions consist of 1 county commissioner from each of the counties within the region. Each regional board appoints its own chair. The regional board's duties include recommending regional operating and capital budgets to the Minnesota Health Board and collaborating with local public health agencies to implement public health and wellness initiatives, and ensuring that all Minnesotans have access to a 24-hour nurse hotline and 24-hour urgent care clinic. Section 6 creates an office on the health planning and quality, of health planning and quality. This office will plan and make recommendations to the board that ensure that all people have access to care and that there are enough health care professionals and facilities to meet health care needs around the state. The office is responsible for quality improvement initiatives throughout the medical and public health system and making recommendations for research needs. The office is required to recommend additional services that should be covered by the plan, including alternative care services, and it must establish a process by which providers can request authorization to provide services such as experimental treatments that are not covered by the plan. The office is required to analyze shortages in the healthcare workforce and collaborate with higher education institutions to ensure that there are enough medical professionals to meet healthcare needs. Section 7 creates an ombudsman for patient advocacy to ensure that patients get the health care they need. The ombudsman is totally independent of the Minnesota Health Board to give them the freedom to challenge problems with the plan or with the medical providers. Section 8 spells out the grievance system to be established by the ombudsman to handle patient complaints. Doctors and other providers are allowed to assist patients in filing grievances without fear of retribution. The ombudsman is required to send written notice of the disposition of the complaint to the enrollee within 30 days, unless additional time is needed to evaluate the complaint. Orders for corrective action made by the ombudsman are binding on the MHP board, but may be appealed in court. Section 9 creates an inspector general for the Minnesota Health Plan in the Attorney General's office. The inspector general investigates allegations of misconduct by employees and appointees of the Minnesota Health Plan, or by providers of goods and services paid for by the plan. The inspector is required to investigate patterns of medical practice that may indicate fraud and abuse, and has the power to collect and analyze data related to inappropriate utilization of medical services and products. Section 10 specifies that the legislative auditor has the authority to examine the records and policies of the Minnesota Health Plan. Article 7, Implementation. Section 1 appropriates the startup funds required to implement the Minnesota Health Plan. Section 2 eliminates the medical provider tax and repeals programs such as Minnesota Care that are no longer needed. Section 3 spells out the timeline for creation of the Minnesota Health Plan and the transition process to it. It specifies that insurance companies and other health plans are not allowed to sell policies for services provided by the Minnesota Health Plan. Some of you have expressed concern about the fact that we don't yet have a fiscal note and do not show the financial impact of our bill. We are proposing to completely change the way we fund health care, and this is not an undertaking to be taken lightly. We did try to pass legislation for a study to take on these questions, but were not successful. But now, through the work of Senator John Dahl, we have engaged the Wilder Foundation to begin a $300,000 study, not using government funds, to investigate the comparative financial and quality advantages of our plan. I might also mention that in addition to the numerous examples of other universal coverage around the world, a study last year in Colorado comparing four proposed universal plans and showed a plan similar to the Minnesota Health Plan would save $1.4 billion. Again, you'll find that in your packet. To the issue of displaced workers, many of them have medical background and training, and we need them working in our healthcare provider system. Those who are not, we offer in our bill access to retraining. Two questions related to ERISA have occasionally been raised. One question is, does ERISA prohibit states from establishing a program like Minnesota Health Plan, a single-payer program? The answer to that question is clearly and emphatically no, it does not. The other question is, does ERISA prohibit states from imposing taxes on employers to finance universal health insurance programs of any sort, multiple or single-payer? The answer to that question is maybe, but the courts have not settled the issue clearly. Massachusetts, as you may know, passed a law in April 2006 that raises revenues from employers for their state health insurance program by imposing small penalties on employers if they do not offer health insurance to their employees. It is now 3 years later, and this law has yet to be challenged in court under ERISA. The Minnesota Health Act relies for financing on ability to pay base premiums paid by both individuals and employers. I recognize that the employer premium could be challenged in the federal court under ERISA. If that were to happen, and Minnesota were to lose the challenge, we would have to either ask Congress for an ERISA exemption, or we would have to replace the employer premium with some other funding source. Do not confuse ERISA issue with another issue involving the federal government, namely the need to get federal government's approval if we want to incorporate Medicare and Medicaid into the Minnesota Health Plan. The Minnesota Health Act authorizes the Minnesota Health Board to seek what are called waivers from the federal law. In this case, the relevant law is the Social Security Act, not ERISA, to permit us to fold Medicare and Medicaid into the Minnesota Health Plan. We would prefer to fold Medicare and Medicaid into the MHP, but doing that is no way essential to the success of the Minnesota Health Plan. We don't need to get these waivers to enact the plan. If we do not get the waivers, then we will have a Minnesota-administered universal health insurance system for the roughly 4 million Minnesotans who are not elderly and are not insured by our state medical assistance program. So to sum up, neither of the two types of federal issues I discussed is serious. If it turns out ERISA forbids us from asking employers to contribute, we can either ask Congress for an exemption or we can find some other source of financing. Turns out we cannot get the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to give us the waivers necessary to deposit all Medicare and Medicaid funds into the trust fund for the MHP. We'll proceed to create a highly efficient system of universal health insurance for the remainder of the population. Ultimately, to institute necessary reform that will have a positive impact on our economy and our society, we need to contain healthcare spending, not merely shift the burden to a new premium payer system. It is my belief we also have to do this without harming patients. I believe the system the Minnesota Health Act would establish will do that. I do not believe we can get the universal coverage without a system that will contain costs. I believe the current system that blames doctors and patients for costs does not address the administrative waste and cannot control out-of-control pharmaceutical costs or the competitive war for more and more technology. I'll now ask that my testifier come forward if that's
an agreement. I know Representative Ava had a question.
All right.
And just so people know how we're going to proceed here, I think we can take a couple of questions just to kind of go through the clarifications on what's in the bill, and then we're going to testify, and because of we started a little bit late and because of where time is, I'm going to try to do keep it to 25 minutes to a side, so if the testifiers can kind of calibrate their testimony, make sure everybody gets a chance to talk.
Try to get through it as quickly as I can.
No problems there. Representative Abler.
Thank you. We've discussed this for a long time, so I'm not going to revisit old things. I just have a new question.
Okay.
Can you tell me, Representative Bryant, is there a model in the world that works like this, or is this based on a working model, or is this a model that you hope for?
Representative Abler, it is based on ideas and plans that are out there, but it's not really, it isn't the same plan that you'd find anywhere else. It has similarities to the plan that I mentioned in Taiwan, but because it would establish a state health plan similar to a national health plan that Taiwan has.
Thanks. And just to be really brief. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the theory, and a lot of things work good in theory, but I have great concerns, as you know, and I just passed out four things for people, just as we look at models that are in existence, and the Canada model has already been plenty used. I just have two pieces about that, and they mean, well, they have a group trying to reduce waiting time, just even There's entities about that. But in Great Britain, which is another example, one of my concerns has to do with the value base. They call it it's a cost effectiveness. It's actually called cost effective analyses. And there's two pieces about that just to look at. In Great Britain, your life is worth £30,000 a year. And if it's cost effective for that, they'll do it. If you're old, you're not going to get it. And that's just a concern I have. But it's all about the money. And people are accustomed to waiting and somewhat rationing. So do you want to just answer that? Because it's going to come up anyway.
Chair and Representative Abler.
Representative Bly. And if the testifiers want to listen to these questions too, you know, you could pick up on what's on people's mind.
Yeah. So, yes, there are, in both the Canadian and the British system, they're trying to make things more fair, make sure that whether you're rich or you're poor, you can have access to health care. And it forces you to make some decisions. The decisions they make in England are such that if someone is very elderly and they have a health ailment that is questionable whether or not they will succeed in saving them with the treatment, they may make the decision that they won't treat that person. Money saved from not treating that person goes back into the system and is available for somebody else who's younger or whoever. In our system, if someone gets sick and a decision is made not to cover them because they don't have enough money, they don't have the insurance, that money doesn't go back in the system to help anyone's health care. It goes to, you know, stockholders of the insurance company or the CEO or whatever. I mean, it doesn't really get back in the system to help people.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bly, what you just told me then is we're going to, and Mr. Chairman, I actually have a specific question, but that comment is concerning. If you have a group out there determining what's medically necessary, the idea then from my read of what you just said is that we're going to tell that person that they can't get the care, but you know what? It's going to be okay because somebody else can get it instead. And so I'm confused at what you just said.
Yeah, I was explaining a question about the British system. I was not answering a question about this plan. I was asked what happens in England. Okay. I was explaining what happens there. This plan is not like that. This plan does not make those decisions.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bly, how does it not make the decision when you have a group that is set forth to determine what's medically necessary?
In general, determining what is medically necessary. This does not make specific questions, specific determinations. Those are decisions made by doctors in this plan. This is not a nationalized health plan like the British system. This is a nationalized, a state health plan. The health plan does not make those determinations. In broad terms, it says what is medically necessary, and everyone knows what's medically necessary as it's defined or agreed to. And those are things that the board would set. But it's not going to make an individual decision about whether or not this person gets health care or that person does. That's the British system. And this is not the British system.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bly, but it says in the bill, and maybe I read it wrong, or I'll reread the section if you can point it out to me, that this board determines what they will pay for. So if something is deemed to be not medically necessary, it doesn't take a big leap to assume that the board would not relinquish the funds to pay for that procedure.
The way that the medically, whatever the term is, I'm sorry, is to set what benefits would be covered by the plan. Okay, and I think it's actually a quite generous benefit plan. And the decisions will not be made by the plan who individual decisions about who gets this or that. If it's something that's covered by the plan, everyone has access to it.
My specific question, Mr. Chairman, is related to page 22, the Inspector General for the Minnesota Health Plan. I'm sure we'll get into all those other discussions along the way related to philosophical issues or differences, but Representative Bly, what I'm trying to find out or understand is on lines, I have it on page 22.18. The Inspector General shall, which means they must, investigate, audit, review the financial and business records of individuals, public and private agencies and institutions, and private corporations that provide services It seems to me that that goes beyond their business books, but it goes to their individual books if they're a person providing services to someone in the state. And so I'm strongly concerned about what that means in terms of opening up somebody's personal records just because they happen to be a participant in the medical realm.
Well, President Black, not to belabor the point, because I do want to have other testifiers, I don't think that what you're worried about, this plan is set up to do. What you're worried about, that from what I understand, is whether or not someone would be denied care by this Inspector General.
No.
Is that correct? Is that what you're
asking?
Representative
Bly.
Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative Bly, no. What I'm trying to understand is just the language that's written in the bill. And so this is a separate issue. I'm sorry I should have clarified that. This is a separate issue in the bill related to the Inspector General's responsibilities and the way that the bill is written, requirement to assess and evaluate or investigate the personal and business financial records of individuals who are participating in the healthcare sector, which is one-sixth of our state's economy, and that's a lot of people.
It is.
That would have to open up their, what my concern is, not only their business books, but the way I read your language, their personal financial records as well. So that's what I'm trying to understand is if I'm right or wrong, or how you see that working.
President Black, I don't think that's the intent of the language, and if it needs to be corrected to be more specific and clear, we'll take care of that.
President Blaine, and I think we're going to go on.
I have a quick comment. We'll obviously be debating the details of this plan, but we do have a system that's in crisis, and I see this as a total system overhaul, an absolutely complete plan, start to finish, and I would just ask you, are you aware of any other example in the state of Minnesota where we have put forth a complete plan rather than just let's cover these people somehow or other, or let's tweak that part or this part? Are you aware of any other complete plan?
No, I'm not.
Let's go to testifiers, and some of the questions might be answered to the testifiers. And I think let's try to keep it to 20 minutes if we can, folks. So just calibrate your time accordingly. Total for each side, yeah. Welcome to the committee. How are you?
Doing well. Good. Being from smoke-free cars, so it's fun to be here. Representative Thiessen, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger. And you've already raised a variety of complex issues, and in the amount of time that I have, certainly I'm not going to be able to address all of those. But I do appreciate the fact that you're asking those questions and having this conversation about this important concept. I am a physician who has been practicing internal medicine, pediatrics, and public health for nearly four decades. I practiced in rural and urban areas throughout the country, and for the last 29 years I practiced in Minneapolis with the Minneapolis Health Department and Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota. In each of these settings, I have been a provider and consumer of care, an administrator of programs, a health services researcher, and an advocate for underserved populations. These perspectives have allowed me to evaluate our healthcare system from multiple angles and convince me that our healthcare system is in need of significant change. Much has changed in healthcare since I began practicing in 1972, but one thing has remained constant, the year after year call for reform, because the concerns over cost and quality of healthcare and problems with access to care have not changed during all of that time. Those calls for reform have brought us managed care with all of the attendant alphabet soup of HMOs, PPOs, EPOs, IPAs, MSOs, and the like. They have also brought us for-profit health care, managed competition, consumer-directed health care, and numerous other iterations of market-based reforms. Despite the call for significant reform, none of these efforts have strayed from the notion of an employer-based and insurance company-administered system, which presumes that the power of the market will bring about the needed changes. These reforms have also failed to veer from the incremental approach because of the fear that any major reform would be politically not feasible. So, after four decades of effort, what have we achieved? The most expensive healthcare system in the world. 75 million people without insurance or with inadequate care. Poor health outcomes compared to other industrialized countries. Maldistribution of resources. A threatened primary care system staffed with many disillusioned physicians. An underfunded public health system, employers unable to compete because of health care costs, employees unable to change jobs fearing the loss of health coverage, an inadequate long-term care system, over 50% of bankruptcies caused by medical debt, average medical school debt of nearly $180,000, administrative costs over 20%, and healthcare corporations making large profits. To me, the data and the stories that I hear every day tell me that our reform efforts have failed. Over 40 years of wishing and hoping that the market would resolve our access, quality, and cost issues have brought us no closer to our goal than we were in the 1970s. Now, when our struggling economy is starkly manifesting the shortcomings of our healthcare system, we cannot afford more of the same incremental attempts at reform. Now, when the demand for significant reform is being made by all those but those with vested interest in the status quo, we are offered an opportunity to act boldly and to seriously consider what most people accept, including over 60% of physicians, as the rational next step in addressing our healthcare needs: an affordable, non-employer-based, single-payer system that provides universal coverage to high-quality care. Ideally, this system should be national in scope, but Minnesotans can't afford to wait for that to happen. That's why I encourage you to support House File 135, which establishes the Minnesota Health Plan. The Minnesota Health Plan will help us effectively address the numerous problems with our healthcare system that I have observed and experienced over the years. First of all, it is designed to guarantee universal access to care, not 95% coverage like they have in Massachusetts at a very high cost. Everybody in, nobody out, including people like those I've served at the Minneapolis Health Department Clinic who had low incomes, limited English skills, pre-existing conditions, and complex medical and social problems, and who have been systematically excluded from mainstream medicine because of their high cost. It'll provide coverage regardless of employment status, allowing people the freedom to change jobs to meet their personal and professional goals. And it'll allow employers to focus their energy and talent on business rather than brokering healthcare plans. It allows patients to choose their own providers, thus reducing the multiple barriers that have been constructed between patients and providers. It'll help reestablish the direct doctor-patient relationship that has been strained by managed care and limited provider networks. It will facilitate rational planning so that new technologies and facilities are distributed effectively. It will also allow the redirection of funding toward much-needed primary care and public health and preventive services, which are being starved by our current system. And it will do all of this and more while controlling costs by reducing administrative overhead that adds limited, if any, value to our healthcare system. Boynton Health Service, where I work now, which serves students at the University of Minnesota, is a good example of this last point. Our small clinic employs close to 20 people in our student insurance and billing offices. We have more people in our insurance and billing offices than we have physical therapists, nutritionists, dentists, and optometrists combined. We need this number to send bills to the hundreds of insurance plans throughout the country and administer the university-sponsored insurance plan that had to be developed because students not covered on a parental employer-sponsored plan could not purchase adequate insurance at an affordable price. Available plans in the community had pre-existing condition exclusions, low coverage levels, exclusions for alcohol-related injuries, and numerous other limitations. A single-payer system would allow us, and thus the students, to save close to $750,000 each year. But more importantly, it would allow us to focus more attention on the provision of health care rather than the business of health. In his speech to Congress last night, President Obama highlighted the importance of moving forward with health care reform. He said, quote, "The cost of health care eats up more and more of our savings each year, and we keep delaying reform. The cost of our health care has weighed down our economy and the conscience of our nation long enough. Now is the time to act boldly and wisely," end quote. Health care reform that makes incremental change to a malfunctioning system is not acting boldly. Continuing to support a health care system that spends 17% of our gross domestic product, yet excludes millions of people, is not acting wisely. The time is now to support a radical, yet totally rational change in our health care system that will finally allow us to provide high-quality, affordable health care to all people in Minnesota. Now is the time to implement the Minnesota Health Plan. Thank you.
We're going to have a lot of testifiers, so let's try to not do that here. Thank you. Any questions, members? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
I have copies.
The page will help you out. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
I will do this. All right. My name is Mike Thorstenson, and I'm from Northfield, Minnesota, and it says on your agenda that I'm testifying as Three Rivers Community Action, which I am not. I am vacationing here today and testifying as a constituent. If you have in the items that are being passed out, right at the front, there's a chart that shows just from January 1st of 2006, with no annual deductible, January 1st, 2007, no annual deductible, highlighted in red, it went from $750 to $862. January 1st, 2008, we went with a $2,500 deductible for the single and a $5,000 deductible for family. That made it $1,010 per month. And if you take a look at January 1st of this year, 2009, the $2,500 deductible, $5,000 deductible went to $1,525 per family. And that premium more than doubles in 4 years, and benefits are reduced, and that's pretty much the story across the country. The Minnesota Health Plan is the only legislation addressing the structural dysfunction of our medical health care complex. It covers everyone in Minnesota and emphasizes prevention, but most importantly, and I will skip through some of my testimony, it creates a system for health care, and it provides a 15-member public board for transparency. I spent 4 years of my life working in teaching and respiratory therapy and 3 years developing and directing Northwest Minnesota Emergency Medical System. I was also a consumer alternate to the Minnesota Health Care Commission following the passage of that in 1992. Personally, and I'm setting this up hopefully, personally I've had extensive experience with our fragmented medical health complex since summer of 2008, and I'm going to read very fast. I had a biopsy done on a small pink spot on my upper forehead by a family practice physician in Northfield. On August 7, 2008, was confirmed to be small B-cell lymphoma cancer. The doctor referred me to a hematology oncologist in Burnsville. The hematologist examined me and referred me to LightScan and Edina for a PET scan. The hematologist also referred me to a surgeon in Edina. I was scheduled for surgery to remove the forehead, the tumor on my forehead at a Minneapolis hospital. I was sent to my local family practice doctor for pre-surgical physical, and a few days later, I was admitted as an outpatient for outpatient surgery. 10 days after the surgery, I saw the surgeon and the hematology oncologist, who then referred me for a consult on radiation oncology in Burnsville prior to starting radiation. I called the insurance company and said I would settle up with them on my deductibles, co-pays, et cetera, for the doctors, clinics, hospitals after my 3 weeks of radiation. And if you're just curious, I'm on the page right behind this on the fifth sentence from the bottom. They said, fine, and noted this in their computer system. 1 week into radiation, I got a call saying I was late paying my share, and when would I be paying? I asked them to check their records for a call, and sure enough, they had a record of my call and apologized. 1 week later, I received another call, now 2 weeks into radiation, asking when I was paying. Again, I asked them to check their system, and again, I got an apology. 1 week after radiation, I paid my share after a mountain of paperwork. Why have I rambled on about this? One, there is no communication system, electronic or paper, that coordinates the medical treatment you receive from each separate provider. Two, insurance companies calling for money before you can look at what share of the costs are actually yours. Who is the patient's advocate, and how do you get control of all those separate billings? How do you establish teamwork on your illness when each provider is in a separate geographical location? And how do you develop accurate databases on what communities may be hotspots for certain cancers, cardiac disease, etc.? So I filled out a medical history for each individual provider, which certainly consumes time for the patient and provider and leads to many errors. I'm going to skip to the next paragraph. My lymphoma is most likely environmentally caused by pesticides, herbicides, and other chemicals. And if you go to the Mayo website, they will reference that for you if you want to check on it. What does it mean that within 2 weeks of my diagnosis, August 7, 2008, my ex-spouse, Mary Hedges, was diagnosed with large B-cell lymphoma? She's been treated with chemotherapy, but most importantly, what does this mean for our children who grew up where we live? I want health care for all, because as a state and as a country, we have already been waiting for 75-plus years, and if not now, when? Eddie Wiesel once wrote that God made man because he loved stories. And I believe that stories create more opportunity for people than all the facts and statistics trying to prove the truth. I have shared part of my story, and I'd like to briefly share the story of my best friend Ross and my friend Jean. The attached are in the words of Kathy and Jill, their loving survivors. There are thousands of these stories that go untold. And incidentally, at the time, Jill had a 14-year-old daughter and a 60-year-old son and worked full-time. Ross had three daughters, one a recent college grad, one a finished college grad 4 months before he died, and one who was a freshman in college. These are their words, and if you go to the first page with the yellow highlighting, Kathy says, my friend Mike says the problem is in the system, not with the care providers, and I believe that too, because the nurses and doctors we encountered over the 2 years of my with my partner Ross Well, my partner Ross was treated for cancer were amazing, and I would concur with that. The providers, the doctors, physicians, and nurses that I've dealt with have been extraordinary. But errors made in administration, record-keeping, and communication remained the backstory to the last 2 years of Ross's life. The first error was the deadly one, failing to notify Ross that the biopsy taken identified cancer. It wasn't revealed to him until 2 years after the biopsy when Ross was applying for life insurance and contacted his doctor's clinic for his most recent records. After the clinic staff opened Ross's file, they realized he had never been notified and called him to give him the grim news that he had malignant melanoma. The cancer had by then advanced to stage 3. In Kathy's words, if I understand universal health care correctly, and I'm going again to the highlights, care providers anywhere, particularly in an emergency, could call up electronically an up-to-date system with all the details of the patient's care, including where it was provided and by whom. Because when people are in a crisis situation, trying to reiterate all that on paper and from memory is more than people can handle. Then, in the 1.5 years since Ross's death, I still appreciated the care given by the doctors and nurses. I also have observed that the insurance company's large HMOs are cross purposes of allowing a person to die with dignity, grace, and serenity. That the period of time in which dying becomes apparent, no matter how long that may take, concern over billings, sorting out through the heaps of paperwork should not be the primary activity of a dying person or his family.
And just so that everybody else has a chance to testify, okay. I just want to keep you just keep that in mind, please.
Okay, I'll skip to the next one very quickly. The next one is with Joe Mon, and again, these are in their words. I had nothing to do with it, and Joe and Kathy don't even know each other. The journal, they had three different employers. Well, first of all, in 16 months from diagnosis to death was October 4th, 2000 to February 24th, 2002. There were three different employer-sponsored group health plans within that time, all of them with changing co-pays and deductibles. 16 medical specialists and 9 different treatment facilities. I will skip the chronology of treatment and facilities, but I do want to quote Joe at the bottom. It's not that my husband died, it was that no one had our back, and it was late in the progression of the disease and attempted treatments that we got it through our heads, but no one was in charge. It's the story of each specialist treating their particular specialty, and none of them referencing the other. It's that none of them communicated treatment plans to our family physician. In fact, our family physician was told by a friend that death was imminent. That friend happened to be me, and I saw the doctor at the coffee shop, and he died within 2 weeks of that period. The point being, it's the story of, and I'll finish the last part of her highlight. It is the story of dozens and dozens of phone calls to the managed care coordinators to get approval for each treatment directive to ensure that it was insured. It's that 2 years after the death, a bill arrived from one of the facilities stating the patient still owed $2,000 plus for a procedure not billed to the insurance company 2 years prior. She attempted follow-up, and the medical facility stated they could not provide detail because the records were archived, but nevertheless, the payment is still due. So she also enclosed a letter and that she had sent at that point in time in 2002. My point is that there needs to be a system of care, and we do not have a system. We have phenomenal providers of cancer care, of cardiac care, and the rest of it. But people constantly get lost because there's no system to communicate back and forth between the providers. And there are thousands of stories like this across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And I absolutely agree with you on that. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment on this testimony. I did not hear any story there that could not be replicated by stories from single-payer countries. I'm not seeing anything in the bill, Mr. Chair, that would prevent what we just heard here today. And I would argue I'm part of the system and have been taken care of very well.
Mr. Chair, yeah. And Representative Gottwald.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you were.
Not you, no.
All right. Hold back. For the interruption, I lost track of what your question was, what your statement was.
That some of the things you raised could happen in single-payer systems and the observation, well, you can say it was that the bill wouldn't necessarily get at some of the things you were talking about necessarily.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Gottwald, what the medical health plan does, it also creates a board where there's transparency within the system. So those kinds of things can be communicated to a public board. Right now, there's no system of recourse to that unless you use a legal system. So, and Thank you.
And Representative Bly. And then the next experiment I want to come down, as your, I'll be quick. In Article 3, Section 2, it says that all patients have a primary care nurse or doctor to serve as a care coordinator. Specialists or other medical providers may serve as a care coordinator if the provider or patient choose. What my testifier was referring to was that there isn't any system that tracks or helps someone sort out these problems, and I think that that is in the plan that would help with that. Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I would just disagree. There are systems in place right now, not only for complaint to the Department of Health where there are situations like this, and there is care coordination. There are primary care physicians in all kinds of cases in the state that are doing a very good job of coordinating very complicated health care cases with great outcomes.
I would say that. And if you can speak, just if you could get the next testifier to come up as we're going here. Thank you.
I would just say we're not saying that it could never happen anywhere in the state of Minnesota. We're saying that in thousands of instances it hasn't happened.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Emmer.
Representative Bly, the thousands of instances that you're referring to, could you get us documentation of the thousands of instances? Because in these committee hearings, when people reference large numbers like that, it would help us as decision makers, policy makers, to actually have the factual backup for those statements. So if you could provide that, I'd be very grateful.
I'll do my best. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And so, just please keep the time constraints in mind, if you could. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Bob Sarnia. I live in Northfield. I am the owner and president of a publishing company that employs 5 people in Minnesota and 1 person in Massachusetts. We write and publish booklets on job seeking, family issues, parenting, among other topics. In the early years of our company, we sold primarily to schools and public libraries. Today we sell to family service centers in the military, state career, one-stop career centers, public and private mental health agencies. I graduated from St. John's in 1970, served in the Army, got a master's in teaching from the University of New Hampshire, and then taught English for several years and ran a program for high school dropouts for several years. During that time, I started, along with 2 other people, our company on Boston South Shore. I'm here today at the invitation of Representative Bly to share my experience as a small business owner regarding the effect of health care costs on my business. So that I could share accurate numbers with you, I took some time to dig out the various folders squirreled away in boxes going back to 1993, which is when the company moved from Massachusetts here. In 1993, I bought the company from my 2 partners, moved here, and at that time, I was a member of the Association of Quick Printers and paid for a family of 4 $421 a month. In August of 94, I joined the Minnesota Employees Insurance Program, a partnership between private sector insurers and the state of Minnesota. Basically, as a group, my premium dropped to $355 a month, which was a significant savings at the time. The Minnesota Employees Insurance Program came to an end in 1997, and at the time I called them and said, well, why is the program ending? They said it was no longer necessary. Rates were quite competitive. Right. At that point, our policy called for a $20 copay. There was no deductible, and it was 100% coverage. As the company grew, my personal philosophy was that what is a worthwhile benefit for an owner is also a worthwhile benefit for an employee. And since one of my new employees was also a brother, that was not a difficult decision to make. In January of 1998, there were 3 families insured by my company, each family consisting of 2 adults and 2 children. The cost for that coverage was $358 a month for each of the families, totaling a little over $1,100 per month. 5 years later, in January of 2003, the second brother came to work for the company. We still had a $20 copay, no deductible, and 100% coverage, but my own family's insurance had doubled to $730 a month, and the cost of insuring three families was $2,300 a month. With each successive year since then, my business has seen significant increases in premiums and significant reductions in benefits. This year, my company covers three families in Minnesota. Children over the age of 18 are not covered by the plan. The plan covers six adults and two children. We no longer have a copay, but we do have a $2,750 deductible for each person in the plan, up to a maximum of $5,500 per family. To cover these eight people, the cost to the company is $4,300 a month. Two sets of parents have chosen to cover four children over the age of 18 at an additional cost of $847 a month, bringing the cost of health insurance to $5,139 per month. That's $60,000 a year to cover 12 people, to which you might add $16,500 in deductibles paid by those three families. And just each of the lines, if you can see it, is a $10,000 increment. The red on the one where there is red, that's the deductible that will be paid by the families. And that's an increase of six times.
And we're already over time, and there's three other testifiers that would like to sign in favor of the bill. And so we're practicing for tonight in Burnsville. We have, 130 people in 2 hours. So if we could keep it down to 1 minute each from here on out, that would be great.
But I'll do my best. One of the reasons that I've been reluctant to hire additional employees is the fact that I would then be forced to choose between further reducing the health benefits of my siblings and I currently have, or finding the money to cover the additional cost of insuring an employee that might easily cost $15,000 or more, depending on their age and family situation. Neither choice looks palatable, and there is no doubt in my mind that my company's health care premiums are the primary reason preventing me from hiring additional employees. I would close by urging you to consider the fact that as small business owners, we are being blocked, strangled by the health care costs, and there is no solution. I'm either supposed to not provide coverage that I think is proper to do, or I can't hire people to do work that I would like done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, is there any possibility of alternating? I'm just concerned that
we're going to go
to both sides.
We're going to do one more testifier on this side. Someone, Ms. Torpet, who has come from farther away, as I understand it, and then we'll go to the opposition testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Broad. I need 5 minutes.
Well, 3 minutes. I'm sorry, ma'am.
Sorry, but I've traveled and I've got a hotel bill, so I'm going to take just a couple extra minutes here.
Ma'am, you should have talked to the testifiers that came before you, I think. Unfortunately, we've warned people in advance, okay. So please go as quickly as you can.
I will. My name is Elaine Torpet, and I come from Fertile, Minnesota, about 90 miles from the Canadian border, and I speak in favor of the Minnesota Health Plan. Having been born and raised in Canada, married to an American, and living down here for the past 47 years, health care has been my great concern. I had to give up my Canadian health care after 90 days residency in Minnesota, and reality sent in. I couldn't get the coverage that I had known in Canada, and now I was pregnant. I'd been admitted to my husband's plan, but there was a 10-month waiting period for pregnancy, so baby number one wasn't covered, wasn't paid for by the time baby number two came along 2 years later. And I became involved with the legislators, and as a matter of fact, Senator Roger Moe joined us for breakfast this morning. He said, "What are you doing down here?" And I said, "What I spoke to you about when you made your bid for a senator," and he's come and gone, and it's still health care. I want to thank Representative Bly and Doug Peterson, Minnesota Farmers Union President, and Tom Peterson, Legislative Director, for having me testify in favor of this. there in our area, there's high unemployment because of health care. Older people are working and taking away jobs from the younger people that need to support their families. And the farming in our area, we're seeing the same thing happening where employers cannot provide the health care. We're finding problems with our companies can't compete globally because of the health care issue. And as I see it, the Minnesota plan has advantages: universal for everybody, affordable based on ability to pay, portable if you lose your job or move, it goes with you, comprehensive, all services by licensed professionals, preventive care, cost less to treat something early, and a choice of providers. Now, in 1962, Saskatchewan, my province, under the leadership of Justice Emmett Hall, decided they would not wait another 50 years to have this kind of health insurance. So in 1964, the Royal Commission, led by Justice Hall, asked for universal health care for all Canadians. And by 1971, all provinces were active in the system. And we're still back where Canada was in 1867, when they put the right to health care into the British North American Act. And only, we don't have a plan now, and there's nothing on health care in our Constitution. And if you're interested in finding the involvement of health care in Canada, I've heard that there is concern. This, I've got some handouts here with the acts and one thing and another. Their system is good, and if they're ahead of us with life expectancy at 81 years versus 78, health care costs at 9.7% of GNP, which I heard was 17% now, up down here, and lower infant mortality rates. Now, we could learn from them and start where they are now. I tried for 47 years to gain back the kind of health insurance that I gave up when I got married. I'm 70 years old, and believe me, I can't wait 50 more years for you guys to get something done. Now, let's use common sense and support this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Ms. Smith, do you want to come down? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Smith. I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm the Director of Policy. The Council is a trade association representing Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans, and our members provide coverage to more than 4 million people. I just want to make a clarification about something that Representative Bly said. He asserted that we have stockholders, and actually all of my members, my 8 health plans, are all nonprofit entities. We do not have stockholders. We do not pay dividends or raise capital that way. So I just want to make that very, very clear. We're not like other insurance companies. My members do share the frustration over rising health care costs and therefore rising premiums, making coverage unaffordable for more people. Healthcare leaders across the world are struggling to balance the needs of citizens with the economic realities of healthcare's rising costs. Recently, an expatriate on globalpost.com wrote about healthcare for herself, a middle-class person in France. She wrote, "I pay more for my healthcare in France than I did in the U.S. I am paying almost 50% of every doctor's visit, even when pregnant, much of my laboratory tests as well. I have paid for about 60% of my sonograms and about 50 to 60% of any of the medications. I pay $50 a month for supplemental insurance on top of the 30% of my salary. The Canadian single-payer system does not cover outpatient prescription drugs. In addition, certain cancer treatments are limited in the United Kingdom's single-payer system. Now, I share these comments, these stories with you because cost is the number one issue, and I think you heard that in the testimony of the proponents. It really is an issue about cost, and so no matter what system provides your health care coverage, coverage for all cannot possibly be sustained without an effort to control costs. Unfortunately, House File 135 doesn't truly address this issue. It's too easy to claim that eliminating health plans solves the cost problem. but the work of the health plans must still be done, regardless of what kind of a system you have. Healthcare is not expensive because of insurance. Insurance is expensive because of healthcare costs. We agree that reform is needed in this country. However, a government-run system in Minnesota is not the answer. House File 135 throws out the entire system, the good and the bad. This is neither the quickest nor most efficient way to cover all Minnesotans. We are committed to making sustainable universal coverage a reality and will continue to work with the legislative leaders to make that happen. And then while listening to some of the testimony, I just have a couple of quick points. We agree with the intent of this bill, and we do support universal coverage. I want to get that on the record. Minnesota Council of Health Plans supports universal coverage. We would like to see that happen. We think all Minnesotans should be covered. But nothing in this bill controls costs. And one thing that single-payer systems in other countries do is to control capacity. By controlling capacity, countries like Canada, among others, Canada controls the number of cardiology centers that are necessary or how many high-tech scanners are necessary. That's how they control capacity. By eliminating the health plan function, the bill only addresses a small portion, which ends up being about 10% of the overall health care budget, 10% meaning what the health plan function is. And the cost of the administration that is discussed in this bill grows at the rate of inflation. If nothing to address the 90% of the cost from the care delivery side is done, it won't make any difference. That part of the equation, the 90%, is growing at 3 to 4 times the rate of inflation. Costs will continue to escalate. You know, I don't want to be overly blunt, but we're about to confront this reality. Our nation's existing single-payer system, Medicare, is scheduled to go bankrupt by 2016. It was just, that time frame was just moved up from 2019 to 2016. That's in 7 years. And that's a system that has that touts a very low administration rate of 3 to 4%, and it's still going to go out of business. Approaches like this bill are fundamentally flawed because they assume that health plans are what is wrong with the system. But even if health plans were to go away, someone would have to address costs. What would be helpful is to change the way in which we pay for care delivered by doctors and hospitals and aggressively root out inappropriate and unnecessary care. And just finally, you know, there are so many things going on. I'm sorry Representative Bly is not on this committee because there are so many things going on relative to administrative simplification and electronic medical records and all sorts of things. So maybe next term you can be on the health care committee and learn more about those things that are happening.
Okay.
I'm not gonna
are there questions for the testifier? Okay, thank you. Ms. McMullen, I don't think I've told you that yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth McMullen, and I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. The partnership represents 110 large employers. Our members are manufacturers, service providers, retailers, etc. I'm here on behalf of our whole membership. As employers who provide self-funded health benefits for hundreds of thousands of employees and their families here in Minnesota, as well as across the nation and globally. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Representative Bly's bill. The business partnership opposes a single-payer system such as this. Our members support reforms that will achieve a market-based, patient-centered healthcare system. We were pleased to support the healthcare reform bill that passed last session and are anxious to achieve potential savings from those proposals. We appreciate the focus in Representative Bly's bill on prevention and early intervention, which is something we certainly hope to attain in any healthcare reform effort. And we also agree with the premise of ensuring everyone receives high-quality care. Our vision on healthcare says that no one will be excluded from health insurance market because of race, geographic location, economic employment, or health status. But this is just one of a 10-point plan that also addresses the market, choice, personal responsibility, quality and cost information, competition, and increased efficiency. And finally, as I mentioned before, that we believe healthcare reform should enable a market-based, patient-centered system that delivers quality care. We believe the key to access is affordability, whether that is affordability for the individual, the employer, or government safety net programs. and affordability lies in restraining the rapidly growing cost of care. There are certainly problems in our public-private system, and we know those problems well. We're trying to address those problems through reform efforts such as payment reform, care coordination, price and quality transparency for the consumer, investment in public health, administrative simplicity, and so forth. However, you simply cannot compare a current problematic system to the idea that a government-funded and run program would inherently rid the system of problems. Professor Michael Porter of the Harvard Business School notes in his book, Redefining Healthcare, that the escalating cost of care in virtually all advanced economies, including those with single-payer systems, are causing them to consider how care is delivered and paid for. I've given you a printout of the webpage from the PBS program Frontline. Last year they did a program, I believe it was April 2008, on healthcare systems around the world compared to the U.S. You can see that each of them is struggling with their own problems, some of them very similar to ours. I encourage you to go online where you can watch that program. Just Google Sick Around the World and Frontline and you'll find it. I'm not suggesting that we would necessarily support the recommendation that this author makes, but it does provide a good overview of some similar capitalist democracies and the similarities between their escalating costs and ours. Let me leave you with a few concerns about this bill specifically. I'm not going to go into depth about ERISA, but we would oppose a waiver to the ERISA preemption that allows employers who operate in multiple states to provide benefits across their employee base. And it's unprecedented for the feds to give a waiver to ERISA. Second, subrogation, which starts on page 10, also will be a major concern to employers, specifically regarding any retiree benefits that they may provide to their former employees. There are some serious issues with Minnesota implementing this alone as a state entity without a federal lead. Representative Bly did talk about the necessary waivers from the feds in order to enact this idea, and it really is unprecedented and would be putting Minnesota forward. Where I think we do lead in healthcare reform, and I think that's a positive thing, but we just are a little nervous about that. My largest concern, however, in this bill is the business health tax, and you can find that on page 9, line 26, that would fund this Minnesota health plan along with sliding scale premiums. There is no further description of this tax, what it would be based on, what rate it would be, how it would be collected, etc. Therefore, it's very difficult for me to address it. It's been suggested that this tax would be lower than current health care costs to businesses, but we have absolutely no idea if this would actually be true. In this economy, when everyone is concerned about jobs, I'd suggest that billing job creators through this unidentified tax for the cost of this plan would most certainly drive jobs out of the state. For these reasons, I urge you to oppose the bill.
President Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question, Ms. McMahon. I guess I'm trying to understand the philosophy underlying your member's opposition. Is it more based on the belief that you think that the government should avoid being involved in what you think is probably a private market and that kind of clouds up the marketplace, or is it that you're not sure or don't believe that costs would go down as some advocates would state for you over time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, our members believe in a market-based, value-driven, competitive system. There are different studies, depending on which group you look at, that disagree on the savings achieved in a system like this. And as Ms. Smith mentioned, the 90% of healthcare costs is the care delivery. And whatever we do, we really need to focus on the cost drivers of care, regardless of how we finance the system. And that really is our focus, where we put most of our efforts towards.
Is that Representative Gardner? Is that Representative Lieber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCollum, I just have a quick question for you. Do you think that the fact that your members can offer health insurance to employees, whereas a lot of employers can't, gives your members a competitive advantage over other employers when it comes to attracting and keeping employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do believe that recruitment and retention of employees is aided with the offering of health benefits.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. McCullen. I just want to make the point that, you know, there is, I think, a competitive disadvantage there, and I think that that disadvantage in a lot of respects probably hurts our small employers in the state.
Other questions? Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Speaking of small employers, my name is Jason Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber is the largest business advocacy organization in the state. We represent over 2,700 members, 80% of which are small businesses defined as 100 or fewer employees. And I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Representative Bly's bill today. Thank you. I just want to echo the concerns that Ms. McMullen just laid out. She went through some of the specific concerns with the bill. I'll just leave it at that. The Chamber opposes House File 135 because we do not support government-run, single-payer approach to health care financing. We oppose this undefined business health tax to pay for any such system. However, I do want to emphasize that the business community is committed to discussions around market-based reform and competition. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Schwartz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Schwartz. I'm a longtime single-payer advocate. I was a member of the single-payer working group in 2007. Strongly support single-payer universal, but I oppose this bill on some technical matters, but significantly technical matters. The single most important thing that I oppose in this bill is that where the bill talks about funding in Article 4, it says in the event that the state can't, Article 4, Section 2, Subdivision 3, that if the state can't get these changes in federal law or waivers or exemptions for federal programs, federal spending, the board shall adopt rules or seek conforming state legislation consistent with federal law in an effort to best fulfill the purposes of this chapter. What it's saying, part of it, is the board is empowered to implement health reform policies without needing to go through the legislature. So where possible that they can do that, they're empowered to do that. That's like writing them a blank check to implement policies that are not identified in this legislation or anywhere else. The significance of that issue is, there's been some talk about the issue, but I'll address my comments about the federal programs and incorporate some of the comments of Representative Bly. A state cannot implement a single-payer system on its own without federal approval. And when we talk about the word waivers and exemptions, what we're really talking about to get the state able to do a single-payer system, changes in federal law, what it would mean is you'd eliminate Medicare to get the federal government giving the state the Medicare funding and Medicaid, but to hand over the establishment and running of the coverage for those people is to eliminate Medicare. Medicare ceases to exist. So does Medicaid. Now, if you want to go for some sort of partial aid, now, if you want to go for some sort of partial reform, there can be variances on that for Medicaid. I don't think the bill is adequately represents the fact that these major changes in federal law are needed. I think the word waiver is insufficient to communicate that. And I think where it does refer to changes in federal law, I don't think that that, from experience with communicating with many people over the years, gives the accurate picture that when people finish reading the bill, that they realize Medicare needs to be eliminated to establish this system. Medicaid will be eliminated to establish what's needed here. So when Representative Bly said something to the effect that there's nothing with Medicare and Medicaid that prevents the implementation of the single-payer system by a state, that's false. It's mathematically false, because with that federal spending and the state's part of Medicaid, that's 35% of health spending in the state. If you can't take that 35% into a state public pool, you don't have a single payer system. You have 35% of multiple systems duplicating coverage in the single state pool. So that's the barrier. On top of that 35% that the state can't incorporate because it's regulated ultimately by the federal government, all single-payer nations have some degree of private spending. England has the lowest amongst the single-payer nations, it's 15%, and Canada has 30%. So if you take an estimate of 15% of spending in the state will be private after establishing this system, you have 35% in federal stuff that you can't incorporate and 15% in private. So the most you can do is 50% of state spending, health spending, in one single pool. And that's definitely not a single-payer system. So there's a problem with the cost studies that have been done. They don't take into account that private spending. They're all based on 100% of spending all in one state public pool. So there's a problem there. And if you're going to try to do a partial implementation of expanding to get a big public pool short of a single payer, those cost studies are out the window at that point, right? They're not applicable. So I think in terms of the debate, this idea of the barriers on a federal level haven't been adequately addressed. And I think this bill should make very clear the existence of those barriers and the significance of those barriers, and it doesn't. There are some things said about ERISA, I'll set aside my comments on those.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions, members? Okay, Donald.
Always.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Bray. And Matt, we'll go a little bit past quarter after. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. And we agree that today's healthcare system has some serious problems. However, we do not believe it is for lack of centralization or socializing the medical profession. Our mission is to support patient and doctor freedom, medical innovation, and the right to a confidential patient-doctor relationship. And to those ends, let me address the problems we see for patients if this bill were made law. First, related to patient and doctor freedom, Health File 135 would limit patient access to care and infringe on the physician's ability to make medical decisions that are in the best interest of patients. On page 2, line 8, note that only medically necessary healthcare services will be available to Minnesota patients. Medical necessity will be defined by the 15-member Minnesota Health Board. 15 people without ethical or professional obligations to the more than 5 million patients being affected by the decision. Furthermore, line 11 on page 7 makes it clear that the board will have the authority to deny access to any healthcare services according to the board's definition of, quote, no medical benefit, end quote. Thus, despite vast differences between patients, these treatment decisions will likely be standardized, one-size-fits-all decisions based not on the needs of the more than 5 million very individual patients, but based instead on the preferences, values, judgments, and agendas of the 15 appointed board members. In a sign of things to come, the bill establishes a new ombudsman's office and a statewide grievance system to deal with the resulting unhappy patients. Access could also be limited by physicians refusing to join the system for ethical and or financial reasons, as is happening today in Minnesota Care and Medicare. Perhaps that is why on page 7, line 25, the bill says that every patient shall have a primary care provider, but it doesn't guarantee that the person that they get is a physician. Second, we believe the proposed socialized medicine system would discourage medical innovation and the medical technologies and treatments that save lives, enhance quality of life, and keep people independent and out of the hospital. Once the proposed Minnesota Health Board is established, treatment decisions and payment authority will be centralized, potentially thwarting the innovation needed
for the development of less invasive, more effective, patient-friendly alternatives to today's care. Therefore, patients may not only be limited to treatments of today, but also the treatments of tomorrow. Finally, related to confidential patient-doctor relationships, on page 18, line 2, the bill would authorize state agencies to collect and share private patient data. And on page 3, line 14, to share it with the proposed Minnesota Health Board. The identification card and number proposed on page 4, line 24, will essentially enable patient tracking. On page 19, it would authorize the proposed Office of Health Quality and Planning to get into the medical records of patients for a variety of purposes. On page 22, it would authorize the proposed Inspector General of the Minnesota Health Plan to inspect medical records looking for fraud, abuse, over and under treatment, and other so-called inappropriate utilization of medical products and services. And they would get to define what inappropriate was. Finally, there are several other very troublesome aspects, such as forcing all patients to have a care coordinator, page 7, line 25, the state's taking of contractually mandated retiree benefit payments, page 5, line 7, centralized capitation payments for hospitals and other institutional providers, page 13, line 11, the imposition of what could be called a ban on free speech related to pharmaceutical companies, page 7, line 23, thus making sure patients don't even hear about new drugs, and the proposed ban on private payment by patients, page 10, line 32. Patients won't even be allowed to pay privately for services denied by the board, and this would be an alarming infringement on their constitutional and patient rights.
In about 1 minute more, if we could.
I have even less than that.
I bet you do. Sorry, thank you.
That said, one of the best proposals in the bill is actually the repeal of the health care provider tax, page 23, line 11. Which is essentially a tax on patients, which is well over $1 billion now. While we appreciate Representative Bly's concern for the issue of health care, we ask the committee to carefully consider whether this bill will actually provide care for patients in need or only promise coverage while limiting access to care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for this witness? Representative Bly, I think we're done. Do you want to respond? We do have some other people that have questions on the bill in general, so it's up to you.
Let's go ahead.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Thank you. I recognize what you're taking on here. I'll give you credit for a great heart and good intent, and wouldn't it be nice if, but somebody in the hallway, it wasn't Britain, it wasn't Canada, and I said, well, maybe it's France. Maybe it's the French method we're looking at here, which some people call single payer, which I went and researched that where I went to look it up, and in France, actually, they pay 20% of their paycheck plus 30% at the door. And so it's a shared model, which is not the model. And so we all work, and I mean, welcome to the committee, and I think she meant that with every bit of enthusiasm. But it's a really hard topic. And so we're all looking for a working model where this could work. And even one of your fellow single-payer friends came down and said, well, not this one. And that's a hard thing. They're all not this one. They're all kind of theoretical. And in Canada, which is the closest model that we can look at, they had to pass a law. The Supreme Court in Quebec said they could have the right to go get pay, not be in the system, and not be illegal. And that's part of the challenge. And to the people in the audience who are so eager to solve this, it can't be free. It's $350 per member per month is what medical assistance, what we pay for that, for people to pay doctors about a third less than their cost. And so when you, as you move along, if this gets out of here, if you're working on this more, you're going to find yourself strapped by cost factors. And read the fiscal notes carefully and listen to the advice, and maybe you'll get something that would work, but, you know, I commend you to your heart, so good luck.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, I appreciate the effort. I mean, we've been debating single payer versus private market when in fact we have a combined system right now in the country. And we've talked about all these issues that we need to get at: cost, quality, sharing of information, coordination of care. They are problems universal worldwide, no matter what system we're looking at. So I commend you for bringing this forward. I really do. I don't agree with it, but I commend you for bringing this forward. By the way, some estimates, and I know you're going to get a fiscal note on this, but I just want to throw this out because this is important. We're talking about close to doubling the state budget, okay? And this is in a year when we have a $7 billion deficit. Now, I realize, you know, you're going to take all the money from one place and put it in another, but that's what we're talking about. This is a massive expansion of state government. It is just massive. The fact that we are doing it in the midst of a country of 50 states, and Minnesota would be the only one doing this at this point, is tremendously problematic. I can't even begin to go through all the problems with that. Where providers would end up going, specialists and primary care providers, if we did this to them, to the system that we say we don't have. Provider reimbursements. Right now, public programs, government-run health care, both in the nation and in the state, underpays providers. Would we continue doing that, or would we pay them a wage that would provide enough primary care providers and so forth to provide adequate access and quality care to everybody? That's a concern. Utilization, when health care is free, when everybody has access to it and there is no cost sharing, I'm trying to recall exactly where that is here, but I circled it. There is no cost sharing of any kind. There is no skin in the game to take care of yourself, to utilize health care properly, and to help control costs. So what would happen then to the total cost of health care? And that really is the crux of it, because cost impacts access, impacts quality. If you can't afford it, you can't access it. And when a single-payer system can't afford it, they ration health care. And that means that elderly and others and people who are looking for care, especially specialty care, don't get the care they want in the time they need. These are some of my general concerns about the bill, and I have a lot of specifics that I'd be glad to share with you outside of the meeting. Thank you.
Representative Broad, and then maybe if there's one more that want to speak. Oh, Representative Blythe,
could I just respond?
Respond, absolutely.
Thank you for your questions. I think that a lot of the concerns about underpayment of providers and things like that, we would try to address. We recognize that that's a problem. And we're not trying to replicate a Canadian system where they spend a lot less than we do. I mean, we would envision spending more than they do to make sure that providers do get the kind of reimbursement that they need. So, but I'd be happy to sit down with you and take into some of into account some of your concerns.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to ask for a roll call if we go to a vote.
Okay,
you got that. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a specific question on the bill. Representative Bly, I'm looking at page 13, lines 22, related to the capital management plan. One of the things that Minnesota is proud of and should be proud of is the innovation in our healthcare system overall. Coming from, I represent Le Sueur, as you know, and being the home of the Mayo brothers, the innovations that they've created in the state and that we're known for are of great concern to me and I think to everybody. So the question I have is related to the providers, these institutional providers, which are hospitals and other providers, would have to come to this board for any capital improvement they make over $500,000, which could be one machine, which could be one bed, it could be one of whatever it is.
Well,
and it just seems to me that could ration quality within the system in that way. Coming to a board to improve my system, my hospital, that's a tough thing to institute, and I hope that you'll reconsider that.
Representative Black, Chair and Representative Broad, the reason that that's there is, one testifier said we don't have any cost containment in the billing. That's exactly an example of cost containment. And it's an attempt to avoid duplication. I'm sure you know the story about the two hospitals in Duluth that both wanted certain equipment and they both ended up buying it. Even though when you have equipment that is duplicative and they have to use it to pay for it, it drives up the cost. This is a way to try to provide some control over the growth of cost of equipment and technology.
And thank you, Representative Bly, for that. And Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned about creating a whole new sector for lobbyists at this board. Because if I'm one hospital next to another one, and I want that machine and I don't want them to have it, we're going to have the MRO MOPA fight continually in this state. And so I think we need to be aware of what we're doing in regards to picking and choosing from a non-elected body who are appointed by elected people. I think that that's something we should be very concerned about.
Okay. Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, Representative Bly, as others have said, I appreciate you and many people who worked on your efforts bringing this forward. We share, as a healthcare committee, we worked the last 2 years on health reform, your commitment to universal affordable access to care for all Minnesotans. My own analysis of both the source of the rising costs, the bulk of them in our healthcare system, and also the most promising potential avenues for addressing the key sources of solution do not lead me to conclude the design that you have put forward with this type of proposal is the path forward for our state. I've shared with you some specifics. Capital management was one of them, in terms of even that other countries have actually already abandoned some of those ideas and specifics. But most importantly, the issue is here for all of us in the room, and many of us care very deeply and passionately about this issue. We're going to possibly experience the end of this session going backwards in terms of access and coverage in Minnesota. And we all know that that is indeed a sorry possibility for many, many people and for us as a state in terms of leadership. I would welcome you and all of our colleagues here to devote ourselves with even more vigor going forward in the months starting summer and fall to regroup on health care access missions or whatever appropriate vehicles are to continue this fight for our ultimate goal of making sure we address this very complicated issue in a very sound and thoughtful way.
And Representative Bly, I'll just give you the last word here.
Okay, Chair and Representative Fun, I would enjoy participating in that, and I think that we should move forward and talk about all the various ideas and try to look at what evidence there is that these things will actually improve. And as I said, we're hoping to get this study to come forward and help us with our many of the questions that were asked here that hopefully we'll be able to answer. So, yes, I'd be very happy to work with you on trying to solve that problem.
So, and thank you, Representative Bly, for bringing the bill forward. And to all the testers, I apologize to the two folks we didn't get to because of time. And we'll, you'll have other opportunities, I have no doubt. But thank you, everybody else. But I think it was a good we've had a good discussion so far. So thank you. Representative Lane.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And at this time, I would like to move to lay House File 135 on the table.
Okay, any discussion? No, that's not a debatable motion. Okay, so all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And we are adjourned.